Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
We're a largely immigrant nation. People just move on. And that's been part of our success. People move on. They don't bring their baggage with them. But that hasn't worked for Indigenous people, because that's the policies of discrimination and disruption have meant that inheritances have been taken, land is gone, language is gone, culture is gone. So that has had an intergenerational impact.
Hello, lovely people of podcasts. Welcome to the show. You are with Catherine Murphy, the host and political editor of Guardian Australia. And with me in Sydney is the Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg. Say hello, Andrew.
G'day, Murphy. How are you?
I'm all right. Andrew is a Liberal Senator from New South Wales. He entered Parliament in 2019. Now, you are not at all a newbie to politics. You've kicked around for some considerable period of time, but you are new to parliamentary service. So let's not assume the listeners know all about you. Give me the Andrew Bragg story in, I don't know, four sentences.
Well, I grew up in Shepparton and I then moved to Sydney after that. And I'm interested in spending my time in Parliament as well as I can. And the two things I talked about in my first speech were about fixing super and working on reconciliation. So that's what I'm doing.
Yes. And just to be clear, Andrew and I are speaking today about Indigenous issues because he's written this new book called Baraja, which I recommend to you. I think it's a really interesting piece of work, and we're going to traverse some of the territory around Indigenous policy in this conversation. As you set up, and I have, you've been active on Indigenous issues since you entered Parliament. And as you said, you used your first speech to raised two issues, one of which was constitutional recognition, and you also favoured a voice to Parliament. So, as I said a minute ago, you've written this new book which sets out the Liberal case for reconciliation. Now, if you've not read this, guys, the book is sort of part history of the Liberal Party in Indigenous policy, and it's part Andrew's views about how what needs to be done and how one might go about doing it. So let's just start with the history, because I found that interesting. Well, at a number of levels, right? In terms of your recount, we've got Holt and Bill Wentworth moving the dial quite significantly with the referendum and with early thinking around co-design, which was quite interesting to me. Then we hit Malcolm Fraser and land rights, obviously significant achievement. Then we kind of skid into the terrible wasteland of the Howard era. See, I said that, Andrew, so you don't need to. Then we move into the Abbott-Turnbull period. Now, both of these more recent Liberal prime ministers were interested in Indigenous policy and Indigenous people and how to achieve advancement, but both of them were cold on the voice. So if we sort of look at that sweep of history, political history, for somebody outside the Liberal Party, there's a kind of obvious question that gets begged, which is that why the stop start? Why are some Liberal prime ministers able to really grab this issue, and including staring down opponents in the party room? Why are some Liberal prime ministers able to grab it and move it, and some not?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd say here. And the first thing is, I mean, I'm not Indigenous and I'm not seeking to speak for any Indigenous people, but I thought it was important that I engage on this material because I think when you stand back and you look at Australia, this is the major unfinished business. And as a representative of the Liberal Party, my concern was that we had not sufficiently understood our contribution, the contribution of liberalism to Indigenous policy. Now, there has been good and bad, but there's been some good. And my sense was that if we wanted to be ambitious in the present around things like the Uluru Statement, we really needed to understand that we've actually been here before. And no one remembers Harold Holt for having delivered the referendum. No one remembers, I mean, maybe some people remember Malcolm Fraser for land rights, but we really need to recapture that if we are to be ambitious in the present, as I say. I was talking to Josh Frydenberg about this the other day because he's doing a launch of the book in Victoria. And I sort of made the point that the Victorian Liberal Party actually, which has got its own issues today, I mean, the Victorian Liberals historically have made the biggest contribution. If you think about the Menzies government and voting rights, the Holt government and the referendum and then Fraser and land rights, I mean, the whole thing has been delivered from Victoria. So I think there has been that strong tradition of experimentation and advancement in the Liberal tradition. And I'm anxious that we continue that in the future.
But it's not so much I'm paying the history, right? The history is as you've recounted it. And I'm not also suggesting that stop-start is the province of one side of politics. Mm. There's been stop-start across the board, right? Like, so, you know, that those two things, I guess, should be a given. But there is it something intrinsic to the personality of the Prime Minister, their own interests? Is it a point in history? Like you say in the book, I think, in passing, you sort of touch down briefly that things were obviously fraught in the Abbott-Turnbull era because by that stage we'd entered the sort of assassination cycle of political leaders, right? So I'm just interested in unpacking that a little, if we can. Is it, you know, does this need to be assessed as a point in time issue, right? That a Prime Minister occupies the office at a certain point in time, they have so much capital, they decide where they're going to spend it. Is it that, or is it the spectrum of leaders that we're talking about, from moderate to very conservative? I'm genuinely interested in the answer to
the
question.
I think you need two things. And I say this as a 36-year-old person with not a long period in the parliament. But my sense is you need to have two things. You need to have a leader that is interested in these issues and regards these issues as serious for the nation, serious in terms of the success of the nation at an individual level, but also serious in terms of the nation's credibility. And until we fix these issues, I think we're going to have a restlessness in many of us. And then you need to have a party room that will allow you to do what you need to do. Now, the problem with the Abbott-Turnbull era is that we left that era, which is when the Uluru Statement was presented. And by the way, the Uluru Statement is the third similar request from the Indigenous people, which follows the 1963 Bark petitions, which was given to the Menzies government, and the Barunga Statement in 88, which went to Bob Hawke, and he said he was going to do a treaty, and then he cried about it on his last day and really didn't deliver a treaty or anything substantive in that area. So this is the third crack. Now, we sort of left that era with two things that were bobbing around in the party room. One, the voice was a third chamber, not true. And two, this campaign from the IPA that race has no place, also not true, because, of course, we have 18 different laws on the statute books today which are race-based laws made for Indigenous people. Native title, heritage protection, land rights, Aboriginal corporations, even One Nation would accept that those laws are desirable and will remain a part of the Australian legal system. So I think what I've tried to do with this book is to present the arguments that are needed to push back on the third chamber and the race has no place angles, because those campaigns have salted the earth in terms of that second part, which is getting broad party room support. Because in the era of closed parliaments, I think, to be candid, you need to carry the bulk of your party room on controversial issues like this.
Well, that's really what I'm asking. That's what I'm trying to unpack. It's sort of, it's not it's not a smart ass question. It's I'm trying to understand the differences. And obviously, for a Liberal leader like John Howard, who was coming after the Keating era and faced off against many of the cultural aspects of the Keating era, and there were the history of the Howard era, I think, would be familiar to a lot of people listening in terms of, you know, it all went to poop in terms of the relationships, and it picked up towards the end. But, like, I can understand John Howard because of John Howard's worldviews sort of being, you know, not particularly open to persuasion on this issue. But I think it's sort of, there's something about the contemporary dynamic that we need to get to. And I think you have. You're basically saying that parliaments are closer, political leaders are living through various assassination cycles. You need to carry the party room, or, you know, or you can't really move that far. But is it priority as well, though? It's got to be priority as well. Like, when, because you came into parliament, you identified this as a priority, right? Not everybody does. So has it got to be priority as well as carrying the party room?
Well, I think we're at a point in time where we could actually get something done that is historic. And in terms of those big historic changes, the referendum, land rights, for example, I mean, native title, which was delivered by the High Court and then codified by the Keating government, I mean, those are three big changes. We haven't had a successful referendum since 1977. If we wanted to have a constitutional amendment to put an obligation on the Commonwealth to consult with Indigenous people on laws and policies which affect them, that would be a historic change. That is something that I think that could be within our grasp. And what I would say about the Prime Minister is he has changed the closing the gap targets radically. In collaboration at the request
through
of
a co-design, through a co-design process,
right? Which has been he's done that. He's also done the funded the Voice co-design. He's also changed the anthem. So I think he has made some important changes already. I am hoping that we can build on that.
Let's think about the Voice for a minute, because you correctly say that one of the things that kind of killed it at the start was this idea that it was a third chamber. I think Barnaby Joyce was sort of first out of the
box. But he changed his mind. He's since recanted.
yes. Oh, Barnaby. Yes. But that was, you know, that was sort of the first. But then Turnbull adopted that language as well, that third chamber language as well. It was, doesn't matter who said it, it was false. Anyway, a lot of people listening, though, to us, will not really have a clear sense of what the Voice is.
Right.
So why don't you have a crack?
Okay, well, it does two things. Firstly, a voice would give Indigenous people a say over laws and policies which are made for them on the ground, but also in relation to national policy. And so there would be a local voice and a national voice. It also delivers a symbolic need. So I describe this as a debate that has hard elements and soft elements. The hard elements are the constitutional elements. The softer elements are the symbolism components. And as Tony Abbott has said many times, our constitution is incomplete. So putting that obligation in the constitution would be a form of meaningful recognition in the constitution, which I think the nation needs to do. So that's what a voice would do. There are many different ways it could be drafted. I've put forward a proposed solution in my book because I thought that it was important that I'm not a legal expert, but I'm a legislator and I'm someone who's had some experience with public campaigns. I was involved with the same-sex marriage debate, and I know that you need to have simple, clean, clear, often minimalist language if you're seeking to get public support for a change like this.
And you do outline, it's sort of, I guess it's stripped back to the nth degree, the language that you recommend, and it's and you raise the same-sex marriage history. Again, if listeners are unaware, Andrew was very active in the same-sex marriage campaign in terms of persuading Liberals to get behind that change. And there are some, well, similarities.
Yes.
There are some
similarities.
Either way, it's a campaign, right? It's like these are important important, historic, profound things, but in order to achieve them, one needs to build a successful campaign around them. And I know you're bringing that mindset to it, so that reflects your own proposal. With that campaign mindset, do you think that you're emphasising the opportunity, right? And we are at a point of opportunity where we can actually decide to not screw this up. We can actually decide to deliver this thing, which needs to be delivered. But there are a lot of distractions, though, obviously, as well. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We're still coming out of a recession. Do you think the sort of broad atmospherics are there in order to run a successful campaign in terms of implementing this thing, assuming that your own party room doesn't lose its shit, not to put too fine a point on it?
I think because we have been promising this at every election since 2007, since John Howard put constitutional recognition on the table, I think at the urging of Noel Pearson, no one will be surprised if we renewed our commitment to that particular course of action. The question would come down to what is the wording that you're proposing. And I think the wording, if it's minimalist and clean and clear and still achieves the outcome that the Indigenous people are seeking, then I think we could put that forward with a decent chance of getting it adopted. You would need to have bipartisan support. And I would like to think that we could use a historic opportunity we have of having Australia's first Aboriginal person in the role as Minister for Indigenous Australians, and that he could work in concert with his counterpart, Linda Burney, as part of that development of that final set of wording. But I mean, I think in terms of the current environment, though, to answer your question properly, I mean, I think we should take a commitment to the next election to hold a referendum in the next term of parliament on this issue. We've been talking about this for 15 years almost. I mean, how much longer are we seriously going to spend having inquiries and reviews into it?
No, well, precisely. But somehow we've got to get ourselves out of the cul-de-sac that we've ended up in, right, which is your purpose, obviously, in constructing these arguments in the way that you are trying to construct them. So, but you also are of the view, are you not, that there should be, in this term of parliament, a legislated voice, so some sort of, I mean, you'll probably laugh or say I'm an idiot, but I always visualise the voice when I want to think about what this thing is. Mm. As some sort of reconstituted ATSIC, that kind of model, right? So I'm representing your views correctly, am I, Andrew, in saying that in this parliament, you a legislated voice, tick, good idea, but take the commitment for constitutionally enshrined at the next election. Is that correct?
Well, what I've said is we should, because there are some people who want to push this into a ravine, which is legislation only.
Yes.
So what I think the most important thing is not the timing of the legislation, but that there is a commitment to end a conversation that John Howard started on constitutional reform with a constitutional reform. And that is something that I don't think we should do in this term of parliament. We're not ready. Mm-mm. I think we should have that commitment, and then I don't mind whether we legislate before or after. I mean, the most important thing is getting the commitment and then agreeing on the words and putting the question in the next term. We have to make sure that we have a good chance of winning, because I think, as everyone has said, I mean, losing a referendum like this would be a disaster for the nation. But we have to be realistic that we haven't passed a successful referendum for 41 years?
Yeah, it's a long time. But still, it's some of the successful referendums of the past have involved advancing the cause of Indigenous people in this country. So sort of two ways to look at it. But and I know what you mean about the ravine about the legislation, right? Because I talk to your colleagues regularly. There are some in your own party room that I mean, I hate to be pessimistic, but I do not see that they are open to persuasion on the constitutional question. That anything that touches the Constitution generates a strong response from constitutional conservatives in the Liberal and National parties. Am I wrong about that? Well, you're a member of the party room. I'm not. I just talk to you all.
Of course, there is a. I mean, the thing is, our policy has been to have have a constitutional amendment since 2007. That's been John's... Sorry, that was John Howard's policy. So that is our policy. The question is it going to be one that the broad majority of colleagues will be happy with? I have to say I've been quite surprised about the response to the book. I think there are more colleagues in the Libs and the Nats that are open-minded about this than I thought that there perhaps would be. I think that there is a... I think you hear about the noisy people who say constitution never, and I respect their opinion on this, but I think it's not consistent with the commitment that we've had since 2007 to recognise Indigenous people in the Constitution. I mean, as Tony Abbott said ad nauseum, the Constitution is incomplete, so we need to complete it. And this is... The Indigenous people are not interested in having, a flowery statement in the Constitution. They're interested in having something which empowers them, provides agency, and putting an obligation on the Commonwealth to engage Indigenous people when we make laws for Indigenous people is fair, reasonable. And this is an important point, Murph, I just want to make that, I mean, at the moment you have a system where you've got 18 different laws on the books made for Indigenous people, special laws, the only racial group that has a slew of special laws, but you don't have a system to manage that. So what you have now is a fundamentally illiberal system. And what I'm saying is, the Liberal Party should be putting in place...
should be Liberals.
The Liberal Party should be putting...
What is wrong with you?
The Liberal Party should be putting in place a liberal system, yeah.
Yes. But seriously, and the whole purpose of this book... Well, not the whole purpose, but some of the purpose in this book has been sort of making reconciliation or making these issues a liberal cause, aligning progress with core liberal philosophy.
Correct.
That has been your purpose, and for obvious reasons, because before we even get to the external constituency, which is the Australian public, there is an internal constituency where a certain amount of persuasion has to happen, and that's where you're structuring the arguments to appeal to people inside your own show who say, I'm not interested in anything that touches the Constitution. So you've said the response to the book has been good. You've had good feedback internally. But apart from laying out the arguments, which you do in the book, for why Indigenous advancement is a liberal cause, and it absolutely is. I mean, it's sort of the staggering thing is that someone's got to write a book to try and point this out. But anyway, you are, imagine yourself, you are sitting across the table from the most staunch constitutional conservative in your own show. You have the floor, Andrew. What do you say to that person?
If you want to have special laws, you have to have a special system. That is the core of this, because denying people a say over special laws that are made for them is fundamentally illiberal. That is the argument. And as I say, even One Nation accepts that there should be laws like native title and land rights. I mean, you have this ridiculous position where you pass amendments to, like, the Native Title Act, and you've got no idea what the people think about the laws that you're changing. So I just think, I mean, you know, we could do worse things and get more feedback from the people of Australia. By the way, this is non-binding advice. I'm talking about non-binding advice. I'm talking about a system which maintains parliamentary supremacy, because that's important to me. I mean, I would consider myself to be a constitutional conservative. I think it's been a good, practical charter of government. I don't believe in a Bill of Rights. I don't believe in flowery statements being in the Constitution either. As Scalia in the US said, if people want to see flowery language, they should look at the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution. So I think if you put a obligation in the Constitution to consult people where you make special laws, that would be totally consistent with conservative and liberal orthodoxy.
But if you get to the point, and I know this is the question you don't want to engage with, but it is the nub of the thing.
Yeah.
If there is a core group in the party room who just can't be persuaded on the constitutional question, what do you do then? Do you step back and say, look, we'll do a legislated model because that's all we can achieve. And progress comes in increments. Is that where you go, or do you just not? Well, presumably you don't want to concede the point, but it is the key. It is the nub of the thing. So, what do you do if you're faced with a legislated option or nothing? What do you do?
Well, as I say, I mean, this is a conversation which started about constitutional recognition, so it needs to end with constitutional recognition. If you can't come to an agreement within the parliament or within the party, then I think you're going to have a major issue, because the commitment that we've made, we have to deliver on. And the caravan has moved on from flowery preambles. I mean, I can't find any Indigenous people who are interested in that. We need to find a way to make this work. It's got to be bipartisan as well, right? I mean, there's no way that a referendum is going to be won in Australia which is not bipartisan.
No, that's absolutely right. And as Pat Dodson said memorably, I think it was last year, he said he was over the failed path of soft reconciliation measures, making white folks feel good and doing nothing to heal wounds or achieve unity. I think that's a very common bit of feedback that you get from Indigenous people. The longer that this has gone on without an appropriate resolution, the harder it is for white parliamentarians to stand up and say to the Indigenous people of Australia, look, can you just deal with this compromise, because we're so shit, we can't actually come to terms with what you're asking us to do, right? Like that window, if that window existed, that's over, right? That's not going to fly.
No. So we're coming up to the fourth anniversary of Uluru in a few weeks. So I think it's a good time for us to take stock on where we are. We have the co-design process, which is underway. The way that parliamentary report, which was chaired by Dodson and Julian Lisa, was framed, was that once co-design was completed, then the government should turn its mind to legal and constitutional arrangements. And I'm, as I say, hopeful that we will be as ambitious as we can be in making our commitment in that space.
What do you think? I just want to do this. We could go on for a bit, but we're up against the time. What do you think about history and truth telling? You address this in the book, and you address, you know, Liberals can't ignore Black Lives Matter and the whole kind of social movement around that, which has kind of jumped into the Australian context, etc. What do you think about the importance of that, of Makarrata, of truth telling, of that element of healing and reconciliation? What do you think about that?
Well, I think in terms of truth telling, of course we should tell the truth. We should tell the truth about the full balance of our history. I think in schools we do a much better job of that now. I mean, I notice it in my own children, but in a place like, I mean, Canberra is a purpose-built capital, right? I mean, it's one of only three. Canberra, Brasilia, and Washington, D.C.
Brasilia.
Right? Hilarious, yeah. Right? If you walk around, I spent half my life in Canberra now, and I went to uni there, so I know it reasonably well. You know, there's no significant Indigenous institution inside the Palmerston Triangle. There's now more statues, as you know, of dogs than there are of women and Indigenous people in Canberra. And there are no Aboriginal or Torres Strait Island flags permanently displayed inside the parliament. So I think that's a big gap in our national life. So I think we need to do a better job of that in our national capital. And I would like us to deal with the flags issue, deal with the statues. And I am very keen for us to fund a national resting place to be inside the parliamentary triangle. I think that's very important. In terms of truth-telling on the ground, I mean, this often comes down to place names, and I think we should be open-minded about having Indigenous and non-Indigenous place names for sites around the country. If there is a role for Canberra here, it would be to fund a commission, as Uluru talks about, or you could get IATSIS, which does a great job, to work with local groups to facilitate that. I mean, IATSIS, by the way, which was set up by the Menzies government, was designed to preserve and protect Aboriginal culture and heritage and language. And that's exactly what it's done with the name of this book, Baraja, which is from the Darugga language, from the Yuin people. IATSIS worked with three local teachers to bring this language back to life, with a dictionary which is now used in the local areas around the south coast of New South Wales. So that is a living example of a program from 70 years ago almost, which is bearing fruit. So I think this stuff is important.
And what do you think about out in the public? Because you sort of mention in the book that we Australians, I think it's Dan Grant you're quoting, that we sort of inhabit our history lightly. We don't, we're not inclined to interrogate it. We inhabit it lightly. Do you think that's still true?
Yeah, it's because we don't think about it. We don't think about it. Mm. It hasn't worked for us, as Dan says, because we're a largely immigrant nation. People just move on, and that's been part of our success. People move on, they don't bring their baggage with them, but that hasn't worked for Indigenous people, because that's the policies of discrimination and disruption have meant that inheritances have been taken, land is gone, language is gone, culture is gone, so that has had an intergenerational impact, which is applied solely to the Indigenous people. And that's why I think, I mean, some people might laugh at me and say this is just symbolic rubbish, but, you know, I think if the seat of government could do a better job of reflecting Indigenous culture, I think that would say a lot about our country. And I think that would help lift the standard. I mean, as Laura Tingle said about New Zealand, I mean, when they open Parliament in New Zealand, they wear cloaks. I think that's a great mark of respect. And I think we need to integrate in a respectful way with the right consent. Some of that culture into our national life, I think it would go a long way. I mean, I think younger people in particular are proud to be part of this continent, which has got this incredible culture, language and history.
That goes beyond the symbolic, I think, in terms of how the House of the People reflects the history and the truth of the country and the continent. I think it is beyond the symbolic, which is your point. Now, just last question.
Yep.
You mentioned Josh Frydenberg's going to launch the book in Victoria, and without putting people into camps and tribes. Seriously, because those labels don't always work. But there's going to, in order to get this done in the way that you think it ought to be done, it's going to take a number of people in the Liberal Party committed to this cause who are prepared to put some capital on the line in order to achieve it. It can't just be Ken and you. It just can't. It's got to be. There's got to be a bigger groundswell. So do you think some of those people who have been positive about your book are going to actually start to carry some water on this issue, start to advocate more forcefully for it?
Well, firstly, I agree with you that people need to take risks. I mean, otherwise, what's the point of being in public office? I mean, the whole point of being in public office is to advance important agendas for the people. There's no point just sitting in the office. So, of course, you've got to spend your capital. I'm hopeful that the capital will be spent on this issue. I should say that Stephen Marshall, I think, has done a great job by committing to putting in place a voice to Parliament when he launched the book in Adelaide. That is creating competitive pressure inside the Federation. I know that other state premiers are considering that. And if the states can stand a voice up in their own jurisdictions, I would have thought that helps Ken. That helps show that it's not a third chamber. It's not going to be the end of the world. I'm optimistic that the others who are proposing to launch this book in New South Wales and Victoria will spend some capital.
Yes. Well, wouldn't that be nice? We're watching, guys. just so you know, we're watching. Anyway, Andrew, thank you. Appreciate the conversation. Again, the book is Baraja, which presumably you can get through e-books, bookshops, etc. Track it down. It's worth your time to process both the history of the Liberal Party in relation to this issue, and also if you're a bit fuzzy on the voice, if you don't really understand what this whole debate is about, because the debate, you know, is continually overrun by other things, there's some good summary exposition in the book that can bring people up to speed with where this debate has sort of gone over the last 15 years or so. So thank you again, Andrew. Thank you to Hannah, who's listening in for a remote recording today. Good one, Hannah. Thank you. Thank you to Miles Martignoni, who is the executive producer of the show. Thank you to you guys for listening and sharing and all that jazz. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.